Welcome to Honey, I'm Homeschooling the Kids, a podcast that steps into alternative education, parenting, and living a funner, fuller family life. I'm Robin, home educator, unschooling mom to two funny, eclectic kids, and we're here to create a space for families to listen, connect, learn from others, and be inspired. Join us every 2 weeks to hear interviews and tips from experts in learning, education, and parenting, and stories from families that are playing full out in the arena of life and education. World schooling, unschooling, alternative schooling, homeschooling, or just creating a whole new style of learning.
Welcome back to Honey, I'm Homeschooling the Kids. And right now we're going to do Read the Reviews. This is a very genuine and informative podcast. The people that Robin features are real people in real situations with great information to offer those of us who are either just beginning our home education journey or well on our way down that path. There is always something to be learned, and it's great to have a resource like this to open up windows into other people's lives, to get tidbits and advice. Love it. Keep up the amazing work. And this is called Love This by App Sucks. So, who did you interview in this episode, Mommy?
I interviewed Phil Johnson.
And why did you interview him?
Phil Johnson, we've actually chatted a bit. We met each other through Instagram, and he is a person that actually I was just really happy to connect with. He's a father, husband, an adjunct professor, professional strength and conditioning coach, human performance specialist. But the biggest thing is he's a huge advocate of play. And on this episode, we had a chance to talk about this passion project of his and why it's such a driving motivation for him. And it's really a personal story. And I loved chatting with Phil.
Okay, so it sounds like he was a pretty interesting person.
Yes, he is.
Is there anything you would like to say more about him?
No, just let us know what you think about this episode. And thank you again, Phil, for coming on the show.
And don't forget to contact my mom if you want to comment. You can reach her on Facebook and Instagram at Honey, I'm Homeschooling the Kids, or through the podcast website.
And you can reach Phil through Instagram. His Instagram is called Got Strength, GOTSTRENGTH, or his website, www.gotstrength.com.
Enjoy the episode.
All right. Today, I have Phil Johnson on the show. Thank you very much, Phil, for joining me today.
Oh, my pleasure.
Phil Johnson is a professional strength and conditioning coach, high performance specialist, self-described neuroscience nerd, independent researcher, scholar, and play advocate activist. He is an adjunct professor in the Department of Health and Human Performance at the University of Iowa, the same department in which he received his Bachelor's of Science and Master's of Arts degrees. His dedication to understanding the dynamic relationship between play, evolution, learning, and the brain is driven by a desire to make the world a better place, not only for his six-year-old twins, Rocky and Denver, but for all children. Thank you very much.
Absolutely. I wrote that in hearing it read back. I mean, it pretty much captures, I mean, that's it. That's kind of that's my drive.
Good, good. I think it's a good drive. Yeah. So let's maybe start how did this start, your dedication to the relationship, the dynamic relationship between play, evolution, learning, and the brain? What was the kickoff for you on this?
Yeah. Okay. Well, I think, you know, I could go back into probably childhood experiences and do a little psychoanalysis, but maybe we'll leave that conversation for another time because that could get maybe a little bit lengthy. But I think, you know, I could probably begin with, you know, my college experience. So I moved to Iowa City, the home of the University of Iowa, after I graduated from high school. You know, I'll just mention I had what I would consider a pretty traditional upbringing in the Midwest, the United States, and nothing out of the ordinary or ultra spectacular. I mean, I maybe would mention in this conversation that I was probably labeled as maybe a little bit of a hyperactive type of student. I never really felt at home in the educational environment. The forced sitting and prolonged periods of, trying to pay attention really didn't fit my personality. But fast forward to, somehow I made my way through the school system. It at times was not easy. I felt that there was maybe a disconnect between my personality. I had all these fascinations and curiosities, like all children do. and I didn't necessarily feel like in the school environment that there was any room for me to really pursue what I was interested in. But fast forward to my university experience, and I ended up going to a school to receive basically an education in exercise science. And I really fell in love with physical training and athletic development. And, after being immersed in that world, both, in the classroom and in the real environment as an intern in a strength and conditioning environment, I started to really find a love of learning, or maybe a fascination or a drive to really kind of pursue. And I would say that, from my experience of working with athletes and being immersed in this world of athletic development, I started to really think about the profession in a slightly different way than I think it's typically thought of. I think most people, when they think of strength and conditioning, they think of someone who, trains athletes to develop the attributes of speed and strength and power, and maybe like injury prevention and those kind of things. And absolutely, that's a part of the process. But the way I started to frame what we were essentially doing in my mind was that we are essentially scientists of adaptation. Strength and conditioning coaches essentially are using the tools of stress, essentially, to force adaptation to the human organism. And so the tools of stress that we use are, various exercises and training modalities. And, somewhere along my experience in that environment, I started discovering that, if you really wanted to understand the nature of how this system adapts, and I'm talking both brain and body, I started to find myself becoming more interested in evolutionary concepts. And I think what that did was it provided a framework for understanding. And I think that's so essential to all of these topics that we're about to dive into, is having that kind of Darwinian approach to looking at these phenomena and where they came from and how they evolved.
So going back to your childhood, because I think this also will tie into your university experience as well. And I totally see you're actually going on the right track. I totally see how it connects. Yeah. So it's not a problem. You were talking about when you were a kid in school, in the traditional school setting, you were very active, and the sit down in your desk for 6 hours a day approach was a little bit difficult.
Absolutely.
It didn't really fit your personality or really your drive or focus. How did you adapt to that as a kid? Because I see how in university, your curiosity and interest was sparked and you chose to pursue something that you were interested in, right? In school, how did you work through all of that?
How did I make my way through it? To be completely transparent, I have nothing to hide. This is for me. I love talking about this stuff because it's truly just a passion of mine. It's like I don't have really anything on the line. I don't have a scientific reputation to uphold. It's really outside even of my occupation, right? So I can just kind of speak freely. So the true answer to that is I just somehow made my way through it, and it was a struggle, and it was almost always challenging. And I would say that there were times where it almost broke me. And I think, gosh, I could probably get emotional if I really start to think about it. I'm gonna try not to go there too much, but I had an interesting moment in my life. Well, I barely graduated from high school. I literally had a superintendent of our school district tell me, Phil, you know, brought me in like a week before graduation. Phil, you're not even supposed to graduate. You know, because I never really just bought into the model of like, I have to please. I was never a pleaser. It was not. And I blame my mother for this. And follow me here for a second, because this sounds awful when I say it this way. But I blame my mother for this, because if anything, when I was at the stage of development that is so critical to forming the emotional centers and balance and structures of our brain, my mother was the absolute true, she was just played the mother role to a T. That was what she did. I had love and affection beyond words. And so because of those early experiences, I mean, essentially we're talking from birth until age 4 or 5, 6, when you really form that, those emotional capacities, I felt truly loved unconditionally. And so when I was then, you know, put into the traditional, you know, system of education, I was very secure. I was very secure in my love. And I knew that I had the support, and I knew that I had someone who was always there for me. And it probably allowed me to be a little bit of a, you know, people would probably have described me as radical. Maybe like, you know, I never bought into the whole, I need to please the teacher, or I need to get an A because that's associated with my value.
You felt, you knew what being completely loved unconditionally was like. And therefore I get that. The confidence and value is already there.
Exactly. It sets you free in a way.
Yeah.
So I somehow made my way to fast forward and just, I made my way through, barely was able to get through high school.
The superintendent that met with you and told you you weren't going to graduate. How did he help you through, or how did you graduate?
It was a she, you know, she just said, and I don't know if this is a story that she was intentionally making up just to motivate me. She said, I'll never forget this until I die. She said, Phil, you're not even supposed to graduate, but I'm going to let you graduate because I don't want you to be here another year. She said, what are your plans? And I remember, because this was always kind of my thought process. I said, well, my dad went to the University of Iowa and my brother's at the University of Iowa, so I'll probably follow in their footsteps and go to the University of Iowa. And she said, Phil, there's no way you'll ever get in. How do you expect to survive in that environment when you couldn't even, you know, survive here? And I remember that moment because I dropped an F-bomb on her and I essentially walked out. And so I had a little bit of a fire in me, you know, from that experience. But, you know, then along the way, and I'm not going to say that, you know, 100% of my experience was this uncomfortable, you know, there were moments where you meet a teacher, an educator, and they just somehow do it differently. And they are able to create an environment, probably much like, you know, most homeschooler or unschoolers, alternative approaches to education do, where it's about, hey, let's get kids excited. And you don't even need to get them excited because that's already inborn. It's just, how can we facilitate that process?
They create an enchanted environment for learning, supportive environment. Yeah,
right. And we all remember, if anybody who went through a formal educational environment, we remember those teachers so fondly, mm-hmm. Who connected. Yeah. And so fast forward, you know, I made it somehow through high school. I went to a community college where I had a couple of really important, you know, mentors, teachers who inspired me. And I kind of found, some interests, but, you know, those interests, you know, can help kind of guide your decisions as to what, you know, academic, you know, pursuit or degree you want to achieve. But the challenge of education, unless it can somehow adapt and evolve, unfortunately, it's missing the boat. It's missing the boat on this relationship between neuroscience and play. So anyways, I was able to pull through. I had probably support of my parents and people around me enough where I didn't ever have a true kind of like breakdown moment where I cannot do this, but it was not easy. It was difficult for me to follow the direction of someone else who thought that they knew better what I needed to learn than what I knew I needed to learn. Does that make sense?
It makes complete sense. Yep.
Yes.
Yeah, I get it.
So, yeah. And then, you know, the one other little just kind of moment that I had was I was, I think, in my first year of graduate school. And like I said, I really did struggle. There were times where I was on academic probation. I applied to get into the exercise science degree program that I eventually graduated from. And the first time they turned me down, the second time I was accepted and I was admitted on probationary status. I just struggled to get the high grades and the test because honestly, I had so many dang things I was interested in and that I was constantly pursuing. And any assignment that I had to do took me on a journey. And I always was like, you know, it's so worth following my curiosity because I just knew that's how I learned. That's how we all learn.
Sometimes it was a struggle because you had other passions and things that you were really interested in. You do certain assignments and you would get completely consumed by them.
And that continued. And I did always find it, you know, a little bit of a struggle to just, you know, allow myself to follow, you know, the direction of somebody else who I just always had the belief that, you know, who knows better what I need to learn at this moment than, you know, me. Not that I don't believe in mentorship and, you know, apprenticeship and that idea, but it's like, you know, I guess I just had this at that time. I didn't truly understand why that was so important. I have some insight now. And probably that's a little bit of the motivation of my journey is to understand why, you know, that relationship exists and why it's so important that we are self-driven self-regulated in our learning. You know, the one, I guess, little story that I just wanted to add to that was, you know, I met this wonderful individual, I think in my first year of graduate school. I went to our student health center and they have like a counseling, program, advisors for people who might be struggling, you know, academically or with whatever. And I don't know why I found myself there, but I was just there one day and I met this individual who was a psychologist and a trained, you know, counselor. And I just kind of shared my journey, my experience in school. And I just kind of, you know, said, you know, basically some of the things that I was sharing with you that I was probably always, you know, a little bit unsettled in the school environment and I had been labeled hyperactive or whatever. And he looked at me at the end of, you know, after listening to my story, and he said with such compassion and conviction that it just resonated like deep inside of me. And like, I remember crying after he told me, he said, "Phil, I want you to know something. Your story is not necessarily unique. I think that there are many people who find themselves, you know, in that same kind of situation and circumstance. But I want you to know something. Some of the most gifted people in all of human history were people who would have been described the way that you were just describing yourself and had been labeled. And there are some people who think that that is the greatest gift, that gift of exuberance and excitement towards learning and that drive and that passion and that, you know, that energy. And so it just reframed, I think, because it's so difficult if you're told repeatedly, you know, that suffer from some type of, you know, it's literally labeled a learning disability. And I'm not to take away, I don't know, I don't want to get into the politics of that, but attention, you know, deficit, you know, hyperactivity disorder, and just the fact that we call it a disorder, you know, frames it a certain way.
It's like saying that someone's not okay because they're not a certain way.
Absolutely.
And it's like who is the judger of this is yes. what makes a person okay and this is what makes a person not okay.
Exactly. So to hear someone reframe it. It was the first time in my life I had ever heard somebody reframe it. And I had a good little cry. And I don't know, it just kind of, it was a little bit of a weight lifted off my shoulders. And now I can just kind of get back to being me, or just, you know, be okay with being me. So that was pretty important.
That was very important. Yeah,
I think so too. It was a moment that I reflect upon a lot, actually. And so the rest of the story really, I think, is almost a little bit of serendipity in a way. So here's kind of the transition into the play aspect. I had been immersed in this world of strength and conditioning, which we always kind of already described as, you know, the science of adaptation. So I already kind of had that background. And my second year of graduate school, I was assigned a teaching assistantship randomly for a class called Perspectives on Leisure and Play. And the professor was a gentleman by the name of David Gould. I had not ever met this person, had not even heard his name before, knew nothing about this class. Well, all I could tell you is there was a day where I was sitting in the lecture hall as a graduate student. I'm just, you know, facilitating, you know, lab activities. But then I'm in the actual lectures to listen to the content. And so I can help, you know, the students learn better about these ideas. And for the first time in my life, I was introduced to the concept of play from a biological perspective.
You know, looking at it from a biological perspective, and how even, you know, from the even before, it's not just mammalian behavior, but we're thinking even with birds and different invertebrates, that there is evidence that play, right? Of the neuroscience of play.
Yes, of a biological system is somewhat similar to what I think every human experiences. And so it sent me, you know, that moment when I was first introduced to this idea of play, and particularly looking at it from a biological, mammalian, you know, cerebral, somewhere in the brain perspective, it sent me on a journey. And that journey led me through, you know, all sorts of, you know, scientific disciplines and different ways of looking at this. You know, it took me to psychology. That was maybe one angle, one lens at which you can view this phenomenon. It took me to anthropology. It took me, you know, to the social sciences. How does play manifest itself in culture? You know, in our daily lives as humans, and in the human experience. And it led me. I literally just kept following the clues. I literally just kept following the clues, and the clues took me and led me to neuroscience. And that's, I guess, where I'm at today.
Okay. Okay. And so what were those clues? Can you explain a little bit more about what stood out for you that made that change your perspective and saw how it is so important for mammals, for human beings to play?
Well, I draw heavily from the work of there are a few different authors, thinkers that really influenced, you know, how I look at this. And I think you know, one of the first authors that I came upon that really kind of shaped my understanding of this concept of play was the late Ashley Gould. So Ashley Gould was a professor of anthropology back in the 50s and 60s and maybe into the 70s. And he was fairly well known. You know, he was, if you pull up, do a YouTube search, you can, you know, find a little clip of him on the Johnny Carson show. But he was quite controversial. And he was controversial because of some of the things that he would write about. They were pretty radical for that time. In which you can get a sense of this in the title of many of his books. But just for example, one of the titles of a book that he wrote as an anthropologist studying human history, human traditions, and culture, one of the titles was called The Natural Superiority of Women.
in which he hypothesized that if you really get down to the biological evolution of the sexes, that women are more important because they bear the children. The book that I was turned on to, that I came across just kind of along my journey, it was called Growing Young.
So this is Ashley, like Ashley?
S-H, okay. Correct.
Growing Young.
Montague. Yep, Montague. And he has a fascinating, you know, what I try to do is when I come upon, thinkers and authors that I kind of start to get into, I always try to do a little, autobiography kind of, search on them or a biography. So, just to know what's their background, where do they come from, and how do they come up with these ideas? And he has a fascinating, I don't want to get too deep into it because that can take us on a whole nother journey, but he has a fascinating story. But the thesis of this book, Growing Young, is essentially that humans, by our very nature, through the evolutionary pressures that guided our development, in essence, humans are what he described. He uses the term, we are a neotenous species. So
neotenous?
Neotenous. So the term is neoteny. And the definition of neoteny is a species that retains juvenile-like qualities, dispositions, physical anatomy into adulthood.
So, and he says that's what humans are.
It describes kind of the process of evolution that we underwent, is that, yes, we are a neotenous species. And his argument in that book, if you read it, is that humans are meant to be playful, exuberant, curious, question asking until the day we die. And so then he asked the question, well, what happened? So you can imagine how,
what did happen?
What happened to him is that he was the head of the Department of Anthropology at an Ivy League university, and he lost his position because he was labeled a communist. And the story is absolutely disgusting. So, we can go all sorts of directions with that. But Ashley Montague kind of just allowed me to start thinking about things in a slightly different way and see things in a slightly different way. And I just started to kind of really view this play thing from just a little bit different angle. And eventually, through my exploration of neuroscience, I came upon the work of probably the other most important influencer in terms of kind of my understanding of this phenomenon is the late Jaak Panksepp. It's Jaak, J-A-A-K.
J-A-A-K-K, because I was just going to ask you to spell it for me. Okay, J-A-A-K.
Yes, and Panksepp. Yep, and Panksepp, P-A-N-K-S-E-P-P. And these, it's so interesting. It's like I read these books and I just, these people, I feel like I almost have like a relationship with them. And it's so sad, unfortunately, Jaak Panksepp just passed away last year due to cancer. Ashley Montague died, a number of years ago. But, I guess there's one intermediate, intellectual author that I came upon too that's worth mentioning was Paul D. McLean. And that's where we got to kind of dive into this brain thing. Okay, so Paul D. McLean is best known for, he's a neuroscientist back in like the 60s, 70s, and he's best known for the book that he wrote, which actually I have sitting right next to me. I'll pick it up, have it in my hand while I say it. The book title is The Triune Brain in Evolution, Role in Paleocerebral Functions.
Okay.
So the triune brain is basically his life. This is his magnum opus. This is his life's work. Mm-hmm. I think he wrote this late in his career. He worked for the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland, and was a senior research scientist. And interestingly enough, there's actually a fascinating YouTube clip of an interview that he does. I've searched for years and years. I came upon this book probably 10 years ago, and I'd read it, and I was just like hungry to. Well, first of all, I tried to reach out. He was still alive when I first read this book. He passed away about a year into kind of my interest in his work. I actually communicated with his son, who interestingly enough, I contacted his son through email, just kind of talked to him about his dad's theories. And his son was like, oh yeah, dad always talked about the importance of play and how important that was. So anyways, Paul McLean's theory is that there were three really important dynamics that led to the evolution of the mammalian brain. And those three important dynamics or concepts are the maternal instinct, right? So how the mother relates to audio-vocal communication. And then the third one, and which was absolutely radical for this is a hard neuroscientist, guy working in a laboratory studying brains, cutting brains open, right? And here in his magnum opus book, his life's work, which was like, 500 pages of really thick scientific jargon, he says toward the end of this book, the third factor that led to the evolution of the mammalian brain and the resulting intelligence that it's capable of is play. And boy, I had questions because I wanted to know, how did he come up with this? What evidence, kind of the questions, we're probing today. And I came upon this interview that I just discovered this 3 or 4 years ago, this interview on YouTube, where sure enough, about 15 minutes into this YouTube interview, he's been interviewed by another neuroscientist. And Paul McLean says these exact same three things that I just mentioned, the maternal instinct, audiovocal communication, and play. And when he gets to play, he pauses and he says, I go to conferences and I tell people this next one and they laugh at me and they kind of like don't understand it. But he says, it's play. It's nothing more. You can't describe it as anything else. It's play. It's instinctual. It's play is play. You can't like slice it up any differently. And so it was just kind of this beautiful like moment. When I come upon, people who can articulate these concepts, just so beautifully, it's just like a moment of like, finally, because it's a difficult concept. Here we're talking about the brain, arguably the most complex structure in the known universe, right? And then we're talking about play, perhaps the most complicated behavioral, system. I don't know if you want to call it a behavioral system, which we can get into here in a second, but the most complex system, evolved system known to mankind or to all mammals. So when you find people who are able to really dance the dance and use the right language to describe this phenomenon, it's just really powerful. And that leads me to the next individual, which was the Yakpongsep. And boy, if there was an important person in this, attempt to really bring this idea of play to the forefront of our conversation, and really help us understand what it is and how essential it is to the human experience, Yakpongsep is the person. And thankfully,
is Yak also a neuroscientist?
Yes. So he's a trained neuroscientist, he has two books. His first book, his magnum opus, his life's work, was called Affective Neuroscience, and he wrote this book in 1998. And he literally coined the term and created essentially a new branch of the field of neuroscience, where in today's university settings, you can even find programs in affective neuroscience, affective meaning emotions, the study of emotions, which has long been, an area of kind of taboo for hard, science researchers. Well, we can't, that's subjective.
It's hard to, exactly, I'll say it's hard to quantify and
yes.
measure exactly. And,
yes.
Yeah. Reproduced exactly, and I understand that.
Yeah, and so all I can tell you, I don't want to even try because I'm not a trained neuroscientist. I'm literally a self. This is all kind of on my own. The last whatever just kind of learning these things. But Jaak Ponksepp, thankfully, beautifully left just a wonderful record of his ideas and his thoughts. And at any moment, any chance he had the opportunity, he did interviews and he did presentations. So you can pull up his name and you can find, you know, 100 different, you know, videos on YouTube. And in his second book called The Archaeology of Mind is just as beautiful as Affective Neuroscience. They're pretty thick. And this is not a guy who's talking like woo kind of science stuff. This is a guy who's saying these emotional systems are not just real, but they have architecture, circuitries, neurochemistries deep within the structures of our brain. And he essentially, Jaak Ponksepp, built upon the work of Paul McLean, because Jaak Ponksepp says there's no way to understand this complicated mechanism that resides up inside of our skull without having this evolutionary Darwinian type of approach. Otherwise, you literally just get lost and you're just, you know, it's essentially just guesswork and you're just coming up with, you know, kind of random theories. And so he kind of uses that as a vehicle to explain, you know, which essentially, if you get down to it, you know, you come to an appreciation that, you know, essentially the structures of all mammals, right, of their brains are essentially the same, right? You know, I just came back from a trip from the Grand Canyon with my brother about a month ago. And in the Grand Canyon is literally like walking back in time, right? It's almost like it's a geological kind of like preservation of like evolution, right? You can kind of see the layers of millions of years of change, right? Well, the brain captures that same you know, process. The brain is literally layered according to kind of, you know, evolutionary forces, and it doesn't when evolution transitions from one species to another, it doesn't reinvent the wheel. It doesn't come up with a completely novel strategy for developing brain structures and brain systems and neurochemistries. It's conservative, right? So it's literally kind of just like understanding the brain from this type of perspective that allows us to finally appreciate, understand, and I think we're finally ready to really implement the power of play.
Okay. I have a few questions here.
Yes, that helped. Good.
So let's starting with Paul D. McLean, and maybe you can explain how Jaak Ponksepp also ties it together. Cause I understand, you know, so the three important dynamics, maternal instinct, audio vocal communication, and play. Mm-hmm. So I could see it how, okay, so a child in the beginning, mm-hmm. the maternal instinct, you have your guidance and your love mm-hmm. and all of that bonding that is essential, right, to set your foundation. Mm-hmm. Audio-vocal communication, I'm saying, and you can correct me on any of this, audio-vocal communication, I would think when you're able to communicate, build that circle of communication where you respond and receive and respond mm-hmm. to build on that foundation that you have, and also a way to better understand your world and communicate with the world mm-hmm. around you, and therefore to build on that. And then play, I would see as a way to, when you're receiving that information and communication, I mean, play is a way for you to reenact the world that you live in. It's a practice almost. It's a way to create and expand without having these kind of, in a way, these scary limits that would hold you back. It's a way of reproducing. Yeah, exact constraints. Thank you. A way of reproducing what you see. And we see this in kids so many times when they're role playing, when they're building. So many times they do what I'm doing, you know, I'm doing what mom does, or I'm doing what dad does, or I'm going to dress up like this, or I'm going to build this because I saw mom building this the other, you know, however they do it, or whatever roles that they, you know, do in their role playing as well. All of that is, I can see those dynamics are very clear, very, very clear. And I can see the importance of that. So then, Jaak, what did Jaak with his effective neuroscience, how did he build on that? What did he say? Is he talking about the our connections in our brain, and therefore it's fundamental in solidifying those connections and making like our synapses in our brain and creating those new connections and then cementing them in? Or what was, how did he build on that?
Good. Okay, you have really good insight. Okay, so this is, that's essentially where this story takes us. And it's gonna, it's so brilliant. It's like simple. And it, and I think when you kind of like walk through it, you really just kind of described it really, really well. But let me just, I think Jaak Panksepp, what his driving kind of mission, I hate to speak for him. He's someone who is, you know, if there's ever someone who truly deserves the title of genius, I mean, this guy is absolutely just can dance the dance and talk the talk without any sense of ego. It's all about him sharing what he knows is very important information in the human experience. But going back to kind of the initial, description of play, what is it? What is it for? Kind of how does it, shape things, and which led you to, the synapses and neurogenesis and changes inside the brain structure. And that is such an important part of this, right? And so that's, let's go there. But let me attempt. Yep. This is not easy. So this is territory, admittedly, where I'm, a lot of this stuff comes from what I've read, but then what I'm, I guess where I'm at now is kind of piecing together parts of a puzzle that I'm drawing from different areas and different thinkers. And so, I think I finally, 2 years ago, and I don't think I would have been able to say to you, I have a definition. I can give you a definition. And it's dangerous for me to say this because the history of play is literally the history of people saying it's virtually impossible to define. And you go into right in front of me, I have play equals learning. I have the playful brain. I have animal play behavior. I have, the genesis of animal play. Those are all titles of books right in front of me, right? And every single one of those books defines play differently.
So how would you define play? Or how would even Jaak Panksepp define play? Because I'm also thinking about, when you had talked about your catalyst was the class with David Gould that you're helping with, perspectives on leisure and play, and how, what was that point for you when you were like, oh yes.
I don't know if there was ever.
How do you define, so what's the definition? And it doesn't have to be the right or exact definition, because that's the thing. I think it is subjective for play, how would you, within importance to our development, what would play be?
Well, let me dive in first to, I think if you ask Jaak Panksepp, I hate to speak for him, but if you would ask Jaak Panksepp, I think I'm familiar enough with, the language that he uses. He would describe play as an affective emotional system, an evolved system of the brain, which has a distinct neurocircuitry and distinct neurochemistries. Okay, so that would be his approach. And I would not, in a million years, disagree with him, but I think what my definition might do is build upon that in a way, or maybe it's just looking at it from a slightly different angle. It's like, for me, what I'm trying to do and attempting to do is try to capture the whole thing. It's like, it's so easy to like get part of it, but are you, and so here's my, I'm just going to give it a shot. Play is an evolved system. Okay. An evolved system that allows mammals, or if you want to go to avian species or other vertebrates, it doesn't matter, that allows mammals to participate in experiences and activities during their juvenile period that will be very important and formative for things they will encounter later in life. So that's definitely one aspect of it, right? There's social integration that comes through play, interaction. So you hate to define something by saying what it's not, but I think that it helps to clarify when you make a distinction that I think to describe play as a behavior is limiting. To describe play as even as an activity is limiting. So once again, the way that I attempt to define this phenomenon is play is an evolved system. In building upon Poncep's work, it has, like we mentioned, a distinct neurocircuitry. It has distinct neurochemical profile. And here's how I almost juxtapose it, right? And so, because I'm thinking about these things for a long time and reading a lot about play and the problems with the definition. And so in my mind one day, I think, I don't know if I just woke up in the morning and had this idea, but I'm like, what's a related phenomenon? What's a related phenomenon? What's kind of a similar phenomenon? And the answer I came up with was stress. Stress. Because what is stress? Stress is chronic activation of evolved systems that induce this kind of fight or flight response. So what is stress and what is the fight or flight response? It's an evolved system that has a distinct physiological profile, and it has a distinct in Ponk. This is one of the chapters of his book, Affective Neuroscience, is talking about. So he basically labels these things as primary systems of the brain, deep within the brain, right? Play is one of them. The fear system is how he describes it, is another one, which we're talking about right now. This fight or flight is a system, and it has distinct neurochemistries, distinct, neurostructural correlates, circuitries, and there's even changes with inside of the body. As a exercise, science, that's the world I live in.
Well, I was going to say, scientists of adaptation, that's exact tools of stress to force adaptation.
Absolutely. So it just kind of came. And so to take maybe that definition, I guess, one step further, it's I would make the comment that essentially what play allows is it provides a vehicle for learning, because learning is so multidimensional, and it's we tend as humans to just destroy the meaning of learning, and we tend to destroy the meaning of what even intelligence is. And we're so far off track in our comprehension and especially in everyday kind of common, vernacular. Maybe if you go into the world of like neurobiology, they have a little bit different, take on those two terms. But play is the vehicle for learning. And so it's through these interactions with the world in this playful-like state that... And so a playful like state is not just an average normal kind of like, everyday kind of, it's probably, you could probably describe that state as it's a state of exuberance, of heightened awareness, attentiveness.
Yeah.
Creativity, imagination. Is. Absolutely. These are all great descriptors of what it feels like to experience these moments. It's, go ahead. I could keep going and I get excited when I. Yeah.
I was going to ask you a question. So, and I agree, play provides a vehicle for learning. Absolutely. I mean, I think one of my, we do more of an unschooling. I mean, we call it natural learning approach with our kids. And one of the books that was one of my favorite books, and I always say, and actually I just recently interviewed him a little while ago and I haven't aired it yet, but it will be airing soon, is with Peter Gray. And his book, Free to Learn, which is really, I loved, I still love that book. And that's the thing. It's, I think so many of us are understanding now much more the importance of play, yet somewhere along the way, we believe that it has to stop by age 6 or it has to stop by age 7 and that kids need to be more adult-like. And therefore, they can't, if they're going to be more like adults,
baggage.
they have to stop playing.
That's what it is. It's cultural baggage.
Yes. Why is that? What happened there in between? And when you have someone like Jacques Poncep and Paul McLean who's talking about the importance of play, especially for importance of play in development and learning, why do we stop that in a place like our education system where that should be the key catalyst for development and learning?
What an insightful and deep and challenging question. I have ideas, and of course I've explored, why in my mind, I think it's we have a cultural history of part of growing up, and I don't know if it comes from like Christian. I don't know if it's religious. I don't know if it's religious in origin. Where it's interesting because you'll hear things in the world of religious thought that the Protestant work ethic and idle hands are the devil's tool, kind of strange, implying that like kids can't be left to their own to just, they need to have the structure and the discipline and the, direction. And, if they're out and doing it on, they'll get into bad things, and that's the path of sin. And, so that's all baggage, And so, I think Ashley Montague definitely, is a resource, in talking about, those kind of questions. Yeah. And at the end of the day, I'm where I'm at with this thing in like terms of like my like life and cause I have children, I have 6-year-old twins, and I hang on to the words of, is it Victor Hugo, I think, who's a French, poet, philosopher, essayist. I think, he has a quote that I have, it's like on my screensaver on one of my computers. And it's like, there's nothing more powerful than an idea whose time has come.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And I think we're there.
Oh, yeah. I hope so. Yeah. I hope so too.
Yeah, I hope so too.
Well, and so let's turn it around to you personally as well, because like you have your, before we talked a little bit about your family and kids, and in between our little sound breaks here. So you have kids, you have your twins, so looking forward and knowing from number one, your experience from when you were a kid. And I know so many times we see ourselves and our children in so many different ways. I think sometimes they're just a reflection of us in different ways and in different stages. How do you see and understanding this about play as well? What do you feel for them going forward as their dad? How do you want to create an environment of play for them, knowing the importance of play? How are you going to do that?
Well, it's funny. I've been asked the question before. Once you kind of understand these ideas of play that you're talking about and promoting, Phil, how does it influence what you do? It permeates everything in your existence. It can't not. It impacts how you interact with the world and how you interact with other people, and absolutely impacts every interaction and decision and the family culture and dynamic that we create for our own children. Influences how I meet people when I have athletes, clients that I work with and teams that I work with. It absolutely influences every decision. And so my kiddos were truly our experiment. I came upon these ideas, maybe 6-7 years before they ever came to existence. And my wife and I share, similar philosophies, but, absolutely. We were going to allow them autonomy. They're people. They are humans. They have ideas. We take them seriously. It's not that they run the show. Dana Martin, I've just come upon her work in the last, I'd say month. But she articulates, this conversation so beautifully that I don't even need to. But I mean, if you really, if you follow kind of her thought process, I think that's probably quite in line with my thought process and my thought process, on this whole idea of unschooling. I mean, I can say it like this. This is probably the best, way I can describe it. Humans are born into this world as question asking, curious, quite literally little scientists wanting to know and understand, who am I? What am I capable of doing? What's my relationship to everything around me, to the other people and to these objects? And what are my senses and what do they do and what am I capable of? And, you know, and so, I mean, at the very first moments after birth, I mean, the eyes, you know, and it's all an exploration and, you know, interpreting what is this place and what is my relationship. And so I guess that very foundation of that humans are born with this curious drive, this question asking, you know, ability and it's pleasurable. I mean, then that's part of this whole, you know, neuroscience of play. It's pleasurable. It's perceived by the subject who's engaged in these play states. It's perceived as feeling very pleasurable. You know, there are people who have written books about flow states and being in the zone. You know, I come kind of from the athlete angle, right? And there's nothing wrong with those terms necessarily, but I think they're really describing is the play state, essentially. It's using different language and just not having a true kind of grasp of the enormity of the concept, really. And so when you children achieve this play state, they're in their element. They are absolutely programmed to be there and to go there. And so, you know, they're learning, in my opinion, you know, this might be more theory than there's absolutely concrete evidence, but it is supported by what we know about the brain. And if you follow kind of along, you know, the journey here, children will learn. They are learning machines. They will do it quite automatically. Doesn't mean that you can't be a facilitator in the process, but I think all too often we are creating barriers. We are creating boundaries and we are trying too hard to guide what they should learn. And sadly, it does a great disservice and can create, I mean, you can really, it can create deep psychological trauma in children who are immersed in an educational system that rewards the kids who are essentially just, you know, better at pleasing or following directions. And then the kids who might have, you know, and I already see it in my own son and have heard it already from the school system. And so it'll be interesting what we do. We may not be in school next year. I mean, we might be in Costa Rica. I don't know. But there are already signs that, you know, Rocky, my boy, our six-year-old boy, we've never felt like he was a pleaser. That's not his thing. He's not here to just like, I want to make everybody proud. He's kind of like, he's curious and he's a tinkerer. And he's exploring. I mean, he's a really kind of playful sister. On the other hand, Denver is a little bit more of like, yeah, she likes that kind of reward, that kind of pat on the back, that kind of nice job. And so in the school environment, we're already getting this kind of like feedback Denver's, you know,
not fitting in with the structure of how they want things. Yeah. Oh, Dot, right. Rocky, right. Yeah. Yeah. Interesting, right? And they're only six, right? You said they're all actually in kindergarten. So they're not. Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting how early. Well, but I guess, you have to start early you have to start the mold early, right? Is the thing, because it's so much easier to mold earlier than to mold later, especially when you have a specific mold that you want something to be into, right? Or be in.
Yes, and that relates right back to this whole concept of play, because what play is it allows the brain in humans to be so plastic and malleable, but that you absolutely can mold, indoctrinate. Ashley Montague uses the word adulterate. Sadly, that's the standard of culture right now that we live in. It needs to be reevaluated.
Yeah. Put it like, and I agree. Yeah. And I hope it does. It's going to be a process.
Yes. But. Yes.
So I'm getting up into my time here, and I wanted to, you know, I want to really thank you for taking the time to talking with me about this. So then, you know, I would also like to ask as well, what would be your suggestion for, you know, because you're someone who as well, you work at the university, you work with a lot of young athletes as well and teams. Are there words of encouragement or something for other parents as well, knowing the importance of play? What are some things that, you know, we can do as parents to better support our kids in an environment of play?
And what a powerful question. You know, humans, as you know, you mentioned, I think earlier, something about modeling, humans, you know, maybe almost all mammals, but I think particularly humans, we are meant to have, you know, the mother and the father or the parents, the caregivers, modeling, you know, that behavior, which, you know, is important for our survival. And so it's just so instinctual. Instead of it being the question of like, okay, how do I structure the environment so that I can facilitate play or encourage play? I think if we can really look within, I think that that's probably the most powerful, you know, influencer that we can have on not just our own children, but on the world, is if we can somehow look within and try to find, because we've all been there. We've all experienced what it feels like to engage in this exuberant, you know, immersive, wonderful state that is play. And so if we can, I have been asked that question before, of, you know, after kind of talking through these ideas, the question that came out from a young athlete who was just kind of curious, because I kind of post things about this, and he saw a post and he's like, well, what do you do to rehab play if someone is kind of like lost touch with it? And my answer, I think, kind of surprised even me, because what I went to is I said, let's look at nature. Let's think about animals outside of humans, because humans are messy. And I said, well, when do bear cubs play, or wolf pups, or you know, we have a lot of deer in this area. You know, if you would be able to go out into nature without disturbing them, ideally without them even knowing your presence, and you would witness, you know, this odd behavior of juveniles, typically, although in humans that's different, but you would recognize that, when they play, when they engage in this kind of like, whether it's with another bear cub or it's, you know, a raven dropping a nut and then the wolf pup goes and chases it, which is another story. What you would recognize is that when animals play, they typically do it under certain conditions. And those conditions are this: they're typically well-fed. So if an animal is malnourished, this goes back to my strength coach, right? So this is kind of was the perfect marriage of these ideas, right? If they're well fed, typically that's when they're going to play. If they have enough sleep, right, that's typically when they feel rested and recovered, that's when they're going to play. They need to feel safe, right? So essential that we establish those bonds early in life with our children. If you don't, if a child does not, and this is the work of Stuart Brown, MD. So he basically looked at work from he's a psychiatrist and MD who studied serial killers. And what you find is people who have pathological, who do absolutely destructive things to themselves and others, have a history of lack of play. And that lack of play typically stems from early childhood, where they didn't have maternal love. They didn't feel loved. They didn't have that affectional bond. Fear. So if there's a fear of predation, or in humans, if we never got the feeling of connected love, and then we don't have the security to venture off and engage the world in play. So once again, the strength coach in me went, okay, so we got to pay attention to fear or stress. We kind of talked about that, right? Stress. So that can impact play. And then the nutritional status of the animal, and then are they slept? Are they rested? And so if you can kind of like, you know, if we can take control of those variables in ourselves and appreciate how important they are, I think we have a better chance of meeting the world through this play-like relationship.
Wow. I actually, you know, that's really interesting because it makes complete sense. And I think of like when I see our dogs and cats around here, or yeah, even whatever the other animals around here, that's exactly it. I've actually never heard it expressed that way, that all those elements that we feed, we need for just healthful balance. And even when we're, you know, in performance as well, right? When you're as an athlete, when you are, you want to be at your peak performance level as well. You need good nutrition. That's right. You need to be well fed. You know, you've slept enough. And yeah, that safety, that connection and safety, that's exactly, because otherwise you're always on the guard, you know, looking for food, looking for making sure you're safe, you know, protecting yourself. You're not in the mode for play. So I think that, yeah, that is essential. Absolutely.
Yes. It even surprised, absolutely. And it surprised me, honestly, when I started thinking about this, I'm like, wow, how fortuitous that I could come to this concept with my kind of background. It just was like, ah. And that's why, like I said, I sat in that class, and when I first heard this concept of play, I just was like, wow.
Yeah.
Halo, like light bulb,
the perspective on leisure and play. I think I want to take this class myself here.
Yeah. And I just heard my kiddos come in upstairs, so
that's
I might
all right.
get attacked here in a second.
We should probably finish up here, and I'll let you get. I think that's actually a perfect note to finish on. You know, when mammals play, and you know, and modeling that's the other thing that you mentioned as well, that it doesn't stop as an adult, that we can play too, and it's essential for us to play as well. So as we continue, so absolutely. Thank you so much, Phil. I really appreciate taking the time today.
My pleasure.
Thanks for tuning in today. If you enjoyed this episode, please share, leave a review or comment. I'd love to hear your thoughts, ideas, and reflections on the episode. You can go to the website imhomeschooling.com or email me directly, robin@imhomeschooling.com.